Guys, we're trying something a little fun and new. We had such a good time during our VR episode interacting with our listeners and getting their best definitely dying stories that we want to ask you guys to share any stories you have with us. So if you have any stories about either thinking you were sick and being wildly wrong, or actually getting sick, or a wild injury story. Basically, if you have any stories you would tell at a party, if it was a party full of people who didn't mind a downer story, give us a call at our Definitely Dying hotline. The number is 323-388-3879. I'll repeat it. And that's 323-388-3879. And you can leave your story on a little Google Voice answering machine. Yeah. And maybe we'll feature it on the show.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be fun?
Wouldn't that be fun? Hello, I'm Madeline Walter.
And I'm Ben Axelrad. And we're both hypochondriacs.
I think I'm sick when I'm not.
And anytime I'm sick, I think I'm a goner for sure.
Welcome to Definitely Dying, the podcast about health concerns, both real and imagined.
Because it's better to laugh about it together than cry about it alone.
I have a runny nose and an ingrown hair. And
my knee hurts.
My arm is kind of rash. Is that a rash? And I had Asian food and that makes me feel kind of sick. I got a thing on the side of my ear.
I haven't cried in 3 years.
Guys, welcome back to Definitely Dying. Thank you for, well, I was going to say tuning in, but that's not how a podcast works, right?
Like, yeah, I mean,
thank you for going, basically, thank you for continuing to engage with your iPhone, which I know you are doing in some form or fashion every minute of your waking life. But thank you for using it for this particular purpose.
Thank you for going to iTunes and visiting our backslash.
I want to talk about something that's not really related to health or hypochondria today, but it's been on my mind a lot.
Okay.
I want to get a haircut.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and but it feels like more than a haircut, and I don't know if I'm going to.
What do you mean? Like, it feels like an identity thing?
Yeah.
Like you want a new look.
Yeah, well, I think, like, so I've been thinking about it for a while. So for a long time, I my big fantasy has been getting my hair cut short like a boy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I've wanted to get a super short haircut for a super long time. And recently, like, I was like, maybe I'll do that. And then I put on a couple short wigs I have, like some sketch wigs.
Yeah.
And I made a very important realization, which is that I don't look nice with short hair. And not nice.
No,
like,
I know
not
what you mean.
Like, I don't look like a kind person. I look like
a science teacher.
Yes. Yes. And I look very specifically like a science teacher who then feels very comfortable berating someone for not bringing reusable bags to Whole Foods.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I looked like smug and a little mean. And I'll post, remind me, I took some pictures and I'll post them because, like, I tried every which angle. Here, do you want to see?
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I don't look good.
You don't look, yeah.
I mean, I don't, right. Well, I don't.
You don't look like the kind person that you are.
And you can, okay, scroll through. There are about, about 16
theory.
Of them. I don't look like a nice person. I'm trying really hard. If you kind of scroll through the whole sequence, you can see how hard I'm trying to look like a kind, good person. And it won't happen with my hair at that length.
It really won't.
It won't.
You actually kind of look like a retired pageant queen.
Yes.
Like that kind of mean.
Yes. I'm
Southern.
Trying.
Southern.
Yes.
Yeah.
I look like the kind of person.
This is the realization shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think this is working.
No, and I look like the kind of person who, like, is like, yeah, I can have a short haircut. I believe that women should be able to have their hair any length.
Right, right.
Which is what I believe,
but
I don't believe it in that tone of voice. And it sounds like I would say it to you in that tone of voice.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
With a y'all at the end, but a mean y'all?
Yeah, like,
I don't know, y'all.
I went to a liberal arts college, y'all. Like, I'm part of a food co-op.
Yeah, like, that is this lady.
Yeah.
Like, she...
And every angle, like, you can see, like, I've just tried so many different ways. I thought I would look
confounded
cute
in this one. Why can't I find that one look?
Honestly, I thought maybe if I scrunch my face up and don't look like I'm trying to look pretty, I'll look more likable. And I end up looking less likable. I really don't. I'm not a likable person with short boy hair.
I'm sure you are a likable person. You are correct, though, that you would be. I would be afraid to approach you.
Yes.
Wherein current Madeline, I think, is maybe the most approachable.
I'm too approachable. Yeah, I think I may be a little too approachable.
Well, I think maybe you split the difference.
Yeah.
Between this and that.
Well,
is just approachable enough.
Yeah. So then I had been talking a lot about this. I was to Marcy, one of our podcast guests. I've been talking about it with both Marcy and Nicole. Nicole was the one with the good idea of trying a wig on.
Yeah, that is a good move.
And that's what gave me this. That's what motivated the wig photo shoot and what made me realize boy short, not good. But then Marcy pointed out a haircut that Rose Byrne has.
Okay. Is that an actress or somebody we know?
No, she's an actress. She's like,
I guess we know actresses.
She plays like the mean, beautiful one in all of like the Paul Feig movies.
Is she British?
Australian. I always thought she was British, but in looking up her changing hairstyles, I discovered she was Australian.
I think I know. Is she married to John Krasinski?
No, Emily Blunt is married.
Okay.
But I confuse the two of them all the time. I'll Google. Let me show you this. Oh, so she showed me a very nice haircut on Rose Byrne.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, the Neighbors, wife and Neighbors.
Yeah, she's the wife and Neighbors. But she's also like insanely, she's both insanely beautiful. And then what I realized, so I thought for a while, for a couple weeks, I was like really hot on cutting my hair, basically like just above shoulder length.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because I felt like, I think part of why I want to get a haircut is because, like, for the longest time I wasn't doing it because I thought for some reason, like, I had to look always the same to get jobs or something. And I think I, like, realized, like, who cares? I can do whatever I want.
You were obliged to the continuity of the character Madeline Walter.
Exactly. And I was like, that's an insane idea. I'm like way more than the length of my hair.
Yeah. Much more.
But like, I guess part of the problem is I kind of like, to be totally honest, I sort of like my hair the length it is. I both want to change it, but also I think it looks the best as it is. Like, you know, so I'm a little torn because what I realized about Rose Byrne is she's so tiny and thin that her hair at the length it is, I think will look, basically, I think I look the most like her with my length. With my hair long, because I'm not like I'm not like the size of a child. Do you know? I'm like an adult.
Yeah. Now, I'll preface this by saying I like your hair the way it is. This is nothing.
Yes.
This is not an either or.
Yes.
I think that when I looked at the Rose Byrne haircut, my takeaway was that haircut would look very good on you. That like I think that might be that maybe
too,
your hair
that.
Maybe it's time to see what you look like with a little less
with
hair. That's just going to grow.
Hair.
I mean, it's but yeah,
I
will say that like that the short haircut. You know, the person it reminded me of was well, no, it reminded me of the reaction I had when Anne Hathaway cut all of her hair off, and then it was like, whoa, is Anne Hathaway mean? Because I didn't think that before. She was the girl from the princess movies. Yeah, she cut her hair
and
off.
Everybody was like, that fucking smug bitch.
That's what they sort of
and then I put on that wig, which coincidentally, or maybe not so coincidentally, is a wig that I have only to. Because I used to play Anne Hathaway a lot in sketches.
Right. Yeah,
there was
yeah.
you know, like when everybody hated her, there were a lot of Anne Hathaway sketches. And so like that was my job for a minute. And I remembered wearing it and being like, oh yeah, this looks good, but it only looks good in the context of like I am playing this unlikable character. So basically I don't know what I'm gonna do yet, but I'm feeling the need for like basically for a superficial change because I'm pretty pleased with the way like my life is, but for whatever reason, like I'm feeling the need for a minor superficial change that says just a little bit, like, I can do whatever I want.
Totally. Yeah. Not something that says yeah. I'm a different person, just something that says you haven't seen every side of me yeah. and don't act like you have.
Yeah. yeah.
But no, I 100% know what you yeah. mean. And I think in general that when a person does feel particularly solid on the inside, yeah. that it's a smart idea to try a little bit of change on the outside, because yeah. those are the moments when it isn't going to completely debilitate
yes.
you. So you might as well see, and I think one of the things that you will learn regardless of how you feel about
yeah,
your hair
yeah.
is that it doesn't really impact. Yeah, it doesn't. It's not going to change how you feel about yourself.
Yeah.
You might think less of me because I'm encouraging you to do it. But hey, you know, it's the games we play.
Well, and the thing I'll say, this is I'm amazed that I have so much to say. Well, actually, I'm not amazed I have so much to say about this because I have endless things to say about inane things.
Can I stop you for one second? Madeline has... You can ask Madeline a question that you are convinced she has no opinion of, yeah. and she has the most thought-out opinion
yeah,
of it.
Yeah.
And it's insane that you would even question. Well, oh, no. Of course the color purple would be. Anyway, something. Yes, go on.
Well, yeah. the thing that really made me, that kind of like really put this haircut bug in my bonnet or bee in my bonnet and wouldn't let it go away was that Oprah said something about, I was like, well, I'll plug a terrific podcast. I listen to the Making Oprah podcast, which is a wonderful and inspiring and like super informative 3-part miniseries about just how Oprah, her whole career unfolded. But there's a whole mini episode about her hair. And she said, a woman who changes her, or maybe her look, like, I mean, because you know how Oprah's always, like, transforming. And
yeah,
she
yeah.
was like, you know, a woman who's, like, not afraid to change her look is, like, a woman who's not afraid to show that she's, like, constantly transforming.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not afraid. I mean, but I've yeah. truly looked the same for the past decade. So I'm going to, so anyway, Oprah.
Let's start the show. Guys, we have a tremendous guest for you today. We're so excited to have her. She is an artist, she's a writer, a filmmaker, a teacher, as well as just a caring and compassionate person that, frankly, I'm happy and proud to call a friend. Stacey Elaine Dachau is here. Thank you for coming, Stacey.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, welcome. Stacey.
That was the smoothest any of my intros have ever
that
gone.
That was a great
I'm
intro.
I'm so impressed.
Thank
yeah,
you.
You're natural.
Thank you.
Take it on the road.
Yeah. Ben's introduction show.
That would be a good show.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll introduce
a series
me.
Of introductions.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
Sounds like a performance art piece.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I kind of love it. Yeah. It's like longer and longer yeah. list
yeah,
of accolades.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
We're all the show. So let's introduce
yeah.
all of you.
Yes, yes. Let's do it.
But today, you're the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Did I say that already? Guys, can never
you can't say,
say
thank
times.
You enough. So we like to kick off the podcast the same way by asking our fave question on a scale of 1 to 10. How much do you think about death?
Well, I went through a period of my life where I thought about death way too much because I was just around, I guess, death a lot because I had worked in a hospice. And then I also... worked at a homeless shelter, and then my father was dying, and then so there was a lot of death in my life, and then that sort of leaked after all those things sort of ended. That thinking about death continued on for another couple years in LA, and that I don't know if that was like very healthy, but and so now I'd like to say that I make an effort to try not to think too much about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
But, every now and then I get reminded.
Yeah. So when you were at your highest, were you like at a 10?
Yeah,
like
I'd say
all
at
the
a
time?
10. Yeah. Like I was, it was kind of, I guess, a dark place. Like I would watch a lot of, I was just, yeah, obsessed with it. Like I was curious about it. I would watch a lot of like I'd research like nuclear war things. Like I was concerned about that happening.
Yeah.
I was worried.
I'm concerned about it right now.
And now I have a baby. So
yeah.
I feel like, and now after the election and everything, I just had to kind of shut down a little bit because I just was getting so upset. I was like, this little being needs not just me being sad all the time.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Also needs votes. Yeah. That baby could have been president.
Yes,
people screwed
true.
It up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He could change the world. He needs a little dose of optimism.
Yeah. The baby's name is Sunny. What better source of optimism than a baby named Sunny?
I know. That was a bit of the impetus behind it. Yeah, just to make him a little happy, happier.
The world needs it. Maybe. I think the world needs
hopefully.
It. So what number would you give yourself now? Like, you could say maybe what you naturally feel and what you force yourself to feel.
Naturally, I'd say I'm in an interesting place now. This is it's new for me. I'd say I'm probably like out of six. But
okay.
I could dive any day to like a 10 and then sort of recover again. Mm. So.
Okay.
What is the kind of thing that spikes it to a 10?
I would say like... Okay, I was driving the other day, mm-hmm. and then I sort of was trying to sort of pull to the side because it was a really narrow street, mm-hmm. And a car, I sort of was coming, and I was, like, nervous I was going to hit the car, so then I veered to the side, and I ended up, like, kind of swiping the side of another car mm-hmm. that was parked, and someone was inside the car, which was, like, terrifying to me. And I think because even more so than myself dying, I worry about her. Hurting someone else accidentally and then having to live the rest of my life. No,
that's my big. We've talked about it a lot on the podcast, but that is genuinely, I think, my number one biggest fear.
Yeah.
And so, like, sort of unfathomable that you could make it a long period of time in Los Angeles and not hit a pedestrian. Like, I mean, it's never happened to me, and I don't know anyone that it's happened to, but they're everywhere. I actually do know somebody that it happened to, and it didn't end up being that big of a deal. It was more like a fist shaking, kind of like, you dummy, why'd you do that?
Yeah.
But it's just, there are pedestrians that every minute of every day, you have to drive literally everywhere in Los Angeles. And it seems like no matter what hour of the day is, there's like somebody's crosswalk time. Like it's whether it's schools are getting out or like there's a hospital every 5 feet, it seems like.
Yeah.
Exclusively when I'm driving high. No, I don't do that. I do that. I don't do that. I do that.
I used to do that a lot when I was in high school or early college. And then I feel like my body has sort of like a weird hangover from it where like even like, you know, stone sober, like as you should be driving, which is as an adult what I do now. Like
there
was like a weird like worry. Or like a reverb of that experience. Because I remember like driving at night when you're a little fuzzy is sort of like the weaving of the highway is like it kind of catches you like a roller coaster. It's like, woo!
Good times, It's like every celebrity died doing that on Mulholland Drive.
Seriously.
I think because I went through that sort of same thing in the high school period of I wasn't in high school, but like early in driving.
Early college,
going through like those, you know, you couldn't necessarily do it at home. So you would go and you get in the car with like a group of friends and you go out and you get high and drive around and then stop at a 7-Eleven or whatever.
Right,
And I think I grew accustomed to driving without paying close attention.
Yeah.
And so even when I'm not stoned now, I still have that same level of like stoned alertness where all of a sudden like somebody will be crossing the road and I'll like slam on my brakes actually like well in advance of hitting them, but it's that anticipation of, you know, because I'm also partly that like I don't want weed to get a bad rap. You know? I don't want to kill another person. I also don't want to make it so that we can't smoke weed legally in California any longer because some dummies plowing over elementary school children.
Well, the more you normalize it, you know, the more you can do it at your house.
That's true.
Not have to just be in your car. I do have like many car memories, like I guess as a, not like with, you know, narcotics per se, but like just like as a young person, like my car was like just, I just loved it. Like, I just loved being in them with people.
You just love to get, like, a clown car's worth of people and cram them into a...
Yeah, and I hate cars now.
Really?
I hate them. I can't stand them.
Yeah.
I don't own a car. Like, I share one with my husband.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't have to be in one a lot. But there was a point where I loved driving and I loved, like, just doing nothing in a car.
Yeah.
Like, just being... Yeah.
And I think that's part of the Los Angeles experience is that you don't ever get to be that chill in a car. Like Madeline's talked about all those countless occasions where you're like stressed driving in traffic to get to like an audition or something, or just the fact that like there's literally traffic at every hour of the day. Like we're recording in the evenings now. I'm going to drive home at like 9:30 or 10 and I'll have to take the freeway to get there. And it's going to take me 45 minutes because there's no period of time that's relaxing in driving here.
Yeah.
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 I wonder, is it 'cause like when you're young, like your car is one of the only places you have like a little bit of autonomy. You know, it's like you're like at home and it's like your parents are there. And like, I feel like a lot of things that I liked when I was younger were like things where you got to sort of play at being an adult.
Yeah.
And then they become like less fun when you are an adult because you're like, well, this is just my real life. Like,
right.
You know, and like when I'm in a car, it's because I have like an obligation to be somewhere. Yeah. It's not because I like, you know, don't have anywhere to go with my friends and it feels cool to have the illusion of freedom.
Yeah. I'm going to try it, though. I'm going to try it. I'm going to go for it. Maybe
just
one
like,
of these.
Go
just
for
like,
a leisurely drive.
Yeah, just go driving.
I think it can be fun at night, like just to, just like, especially if you go to like an area where there maybe aren't quite as many city lights, like if you head west, like towards, you could, but I mean, I was thinking more like Topanga or something like
that, or
towards like Malibu, that you get to these certain areas where like you can kind of just look up at the night stars, and it is a very introspective, I think, experience.
Yeah.
The problem being that, like, when you're in these urban areas, like when we're in this city life,
the threat of people.
Yeah, you can't afford to be introspective for long enough for it to actually materialize into anything.
Yeah. No, it's true. Do you ever go to any like lookouts in LA? Like, I'm gonna go to this. When I lived in Colorado, I would like drive to like, you know, part of like a mountain, and I'd be like, I'm just gonna look out at the city.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm just gonna. But I also was in my early 20s. I don't know if that's like a thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Maybe
I do a little bit on Mount Washington, where my aunt and uncle live. That you can just sort of just look out
the
over
view.
Downtown.
You're like, I just gotta take, you know, step back.
Yeah. Oh, that's tell them I'm coming. I just hit that view. Oh, I'm out of town. Sorry.
There's a lookout, like, there's some lookouts, around here that I've been to, but a lookout really makes me think of also being in high school. Like, there was this, like, one, I grew up in a little town in New Jersey, and there was, like, this sort of wildlife reservation called, like, the South Mountain Reservation, and there was, like, a lookout where you could go and look out and, like, look at the New York skyline.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we were told that you really couldn't go at night because, couple bodies had been found in suitcases in the South Mountain Reservation.
Whoa.
And then we were also warned that it was like a real like spot where like people cruise, which like now doesn't seem scary.
What do you mean?
Like I guess like gay men cruise for sex, but that
like a truck stop kind of experience.
Yeah, but that to me, I don't know, that seemed like
it's similar to my
when it was said to me, I was like, ooh, scary. But now thinking about it, I'm like, I guess that's not. Like, that doesn't sound like a scary thing.
It's like my
bodies
hot tub
and suitcases.
Thing.
Yeah.
Like, there was just a bad rap that was given to, like, a section of our population.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Either of you ever made out at a makeout point?
No, I was tried
probably.
A makeout was proposed to me at a makeout point, and I politely declined.
Madeline, you turned makeout point into point.
Did you know you were at a makeout point, or like you got to the point and then you realized
it was the same? Okay. It was that same South Mountain Reservation lookout. Okay. That was sort of our all-purpose lookout.
Do you remember your exact wording when you said no? Did you just say no, thank you?
I had to give some speech about not wanting to ruin a friendship or something.
Oh, God.
Which was true. It was true. It felt so bad because it was this like, it was a makeout point.
Yeah.
I did not make out at it.
Sully this majestic view of the city.
I said no thank you to many of my first kiss opportunities also. My first two quote-unquote, like, boyfriends.
You said no thank you to boyfriends?
Yes! It wasn't religious. It's crazy to me that I had such... I had all of the, like, trappings of a person who would have been raised very religious, but my parents were both... Like, they were both such wild hippies when they were young. And then like, very, like, normal, like, kind of the perfectly right amount of discipline as parents. And mostly the kind of parents who just trusted me. And then I think it gave me this deep sense of self-regulation.
That's amazing.
Because I, like, didn't want to, like, betray their trust. But kissing a person, like, it bled into, like, this weird kind of puritanical place. And I remember my first boyfriend, I was 13 years old, or 8th grade. Is that 13?
That's 7th, 8th.
Billy MacArthur, who was so cute. He went to a different school, so that's how I was able to date him, even though he was cute, because I wasn't popular in my middle school, but he went to, like, a private school. And I remember we had a phone conversation about how I wasn't ready to kiss yet. And then he broke up with me.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it's a good thing you didn't kiss him.
I mean, I remember literally having a telephone conversation saying the words, I don't think we're ready to kiss.
I would have been so mad if you, like, you basically told him you just wanted to be friends, but still made him break up with you.
And I also liked him so much. He was so cute. He was such a good boyfriend.
I would say that is the quintessential middle school boyfriend name. What was it again? Billy MacArthur. Yeah, that is the quintessential middle school boyfriend
name.
And
then I got another boyfriend, like a couple, another air quotes boyfriend a couple months later named Dylan Hacker, who had an elevator in his house.
Oh, Jesus.
Which is not, I didn't grow up in a fancy town. There was just one fancy part.
Yeah.
And he was a new kid in school with an elevator in his house, but had a lot of acne, so that's why he was able to date me. Like, yeah, he had an elevator.
Oh my gosh.
And he asked if he could kiss me when we were seeing Austin Powers 2.
In the movies?
In the movies. He said, like, he like turned to me and was like, can I kiss you? And I also said, no, thank you.
With a name like Dylan Hacker, my guess would be if you rejected kissing him, he would shoot up the entire movie.
I know.
Everyone's dead. Everyone who's rejected him is dead, and it started with you. Thank God you're here.
Well, maybe you were just like wanted to be more romantic.
Yeah.
Like, really, you're like, I don't want to kiss that in the middle of an Austin Powers movie.
Yeah, I was I got to watch the movie. It's too good. It was one of the three times I saw that movie in the theater.
Nobody will let you just look out at the thing you're trying to look out at. You got a great piece of landscape ahead of you, and people are just like, let's swap spit. Come on. I'm trying to have an experience that's going to change me.
Did you ever make out in a theater?
No, I've never. I still haven't made it. He'll try to cruise me at make out points, but that's about the extent of it. No, no, I never. No, I've never been to a make out point. Never kissed. And what about you? Have you been to a point or a make out movie?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, it's all a blur. But yeah, I know. I worked at a movie theater for a long time. Oh. Yeah.
Well, tell us that story. And then we got to get to your other job stories. Because I feel like that's the
crux.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't want to bury the lead here.
No.
I don't have a good story about the movie theater except that I worked there.
Okay. Well, then can we get right into the let's talk about would it be called hospice what you worked in?
Yeah, it was a hospice. It was sort of like a nonprofit type of hospice. You know, it was like a hippie place. It was in Boulder, Colorado. Mm-hmm. They hired artists instead of like nurses to sort of like there was like a nurse or two that sort of like oversaw the program.
Yeah.
I should explain. So it was a hospice, but it wasn't in a like an institutional building that's sort of outside of the community.
Yeah.
The person that started the home wanted to integrate people who are dying into the community. So she made this sort of nonprofit hospice organization, and it was in a residential house. So there would be like 7 or 8 residents living in the house, and then 2 to 3, and sometimes 1, like caregiver on duty in the house. So you'd go to the house, you would cook for them, you change them, you'd be with them, like you would make art with them, you'd plant with them, you'd just hang out with them, like you were kind of like it was like your grandmother or like a friend of yours that you had.
Yeah.
So it wasn't too sterile of an environment. And I worked there, I guess, in 2004, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you feel yourself getting close to the – how does it – when you know that someone is going to part soon, how does that impact how well you get to know them? Do you get to know them even more intimately, or is there a feeling like you want to retract a little bit out of fear?
Well, it's interesting because the people I took care of, and one thing I thought was really special about this place where I worked, is they provided a kind of pamphlet. So with each resident, there was a bio, and it told you about like what they did when they were younger.
Oh,
and
that's great.
What they achieved, so you knew they weren't just this person who can't talk and has one breast and is, you know, like, this was like a scientist who studied earthquakes in Japan and, you know, was one of the first female scientists that ever to do that. And so you had an understanding that this person has a history.
Yeah.
You're not going to talk to them like they're this imbecile. Yeah, like, they're this just dummy who's, like, you know, because sometimes people do talk to people often, who are, like, like their children.
Yeah.
Which is really frustrating. So, you know, it kind of gives you a good context for the person behind, you know, the illness.
Yeah.
And also just the age and everything. So.
Yeah.
So that was really helpful in sort of connecting with people.
Yeah. I'd like to have that. Yeah. I'd like to have a... It's always nice when we, like, just know... Like, you sent us... our last week's guest, Mono, did also. You sent us, like, sort of a roadmap for things that we could talk about. It's always nice to know what would be interesting for a person to talk about, what's a sensitive subject for someone to talk about. Like, you can just sort of, like, then really sort of get into the meat of it, you know, as opposed to sort of having to play around the periphery, sort of like, well, would it be okay if we talked about this kind of thing? Like,
Well, I love talking... That's why I'm excited to be here, because I love talking about it. It's a time in my life. It was like just really raw. I had a lot of strange jobs that I had just come off of graduating from graduate school
in
writing and poetics.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
In Colorado?
In Boulder, Colorado. I went to this like other hippie graduate school called Naropa University. It's a Buddhist school. The writing program was started by Ann Waldman and Allen Ginsberg in 1974.
Wow.
Yeah, it's the Disembodied School of Poetics or something like
that. Wow. Oh, that's a cool name.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
The Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
That is actually the full name. Yeah.
That's nuts. Yeah.
Sounds like a Lemony Snicket book.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you came off of, how long was that a 1 year program?
It was
a 2 year
program. Cool. Yeah. So I just graduated and I was like sending out, trying to teach. I was sending out like applications. Nothing was really coming back at me.
Yeah.
I needed to find a job. And then, I just like kind of took like a job at this hospice. And then I worked at the graveyard shift at a homeless shelter too. So I had kind of, and then I worked at a coffee shop. So I had like three sort of like not like very well paying jobs, but very interesting jobs where I met characters and had experiences, and I learned a lot about myself in the process. So I love that time, and I don't get to talk about it. It's like now, like 10 plus years ago. I would love to talk about it. So I'm happy to.
That sounds like a real Jack Kerouac experience that you had coming out of the Jack Kerouac school.
I love, I guess I love outsider art. I love people who sort of don't just follow like that one sort of academic cycle. I want people in my life who've had lots of interesting artistic experiences, and I wanted to have those too, just like life experiences in addition to art experiences. So.
Definitely.
What was, so when you were working at that hospice, was your job, so you were one of the people who was there to just sort of like be with the people.
Yeah.
Did you like form a strong relationship with any specific of those people? Like, are there any that you like think of a lot or remember often?
There's this one woman who I loved, and her name was Pinky, and she was really special to me. She couldn't speak. She was a huge, you know, protester of like the Vietnam War, and she just was really like strong-willed, very much a feminist, and like she had two twin daughters. It would come one would come in the morning and one would come in the night day.
Wow.
And like tie her shoes and take her on a walk, and it was just seeing their bond was really special. And it was an interesting relationship to have, because I mean, I was at the time in my early 20s, so I'd the only kind of naked-ish body I'd ever seen was like someone I was in a romantic relationship with. It wasn't like a stranger.
Right. Yeah.
The first day I had to go to this house and take someone's clothes off.
Yeah.
And that's a person who's a vulnerable person, you know, and it's a vulnerable thing to do. And it was kind of scary, but you know, you're getting paid to do it. You have to do it, and they need you to do it. So but you also want to not make the person feel, you know, like that they're not a strong person, that they haven't lived this full life.
Yeah.
So I would always talk to this individual, Pinky, who I really liked. And I would just would be like, hey, I know this is ridiculous. I'm going to have to just put your arm over here and do this.
Oh, yeah.
And I know you're strong and you can do it yourself, but hey, they're paying me, so why not get it for free? You know? I was like,
that's great.
Like make jokes and
stuff.
Yeah.
And she'd like laugh. Like I don't think she had Alzheimer's. I don't know if she like got who I was, but the thing was, like, if you create an energy or feeling, it's comfortable.
Yeah,
this is someone you should know, then it was never a problem to do that stuff, you know, because it's like, even if she doesn't know who I am, she knows that the energy I'm sort of giving her is that, like, it's a familiar energy.
Definitely.
So she would relax a little, and we'd laugh and had a really special time. And I forgot after a while that she couldn't talk, which is also strange. Yeah. And I'd be like, I feel like I know this person.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm having conversations with this person, but she can't talk at all.
Yeah.
And it was weird. It was like a weird realization. And I'd have to like take her to the bathroom and wait. And sometimes, you know, like kind of wipe and do all that kind of stuff you need to do. And, you know, just sitting there. And sometimes it takes a long time. And I would just kind of do a monologue, like telling her about my life. And then she would just kind of, you know, but it's like, you just share that space and you forget that so much of communicating and bonding isn't about talking. It's just so interesting.
That's so interesting. Yeah. It's so interesting how much, I mean, this sounds so stupid compared to that, but it's something that I think about a little bit with my cat, which is like, I mean, just like in like the tiniest degree, just like how much that's like, you know, another like being that like, you know, we like share our space with, and how much of the time it feels like we're communicating and like very simple things, you know, like where do you want to go, or like you're happy right now, you're calm right now, but how much like there is very real communication happening and it's not verbal at all, and how much like energetically what you're putting out there is like a real impalpable thing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, other creatures.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're all these little creatures trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
Who's safe? I don't know.
That is the big thing, though, right? Like, when you first interact with somebody, all they're really trying to figure out is this a friend or is this a foe? You know, like, can I trust this person? And so you just do what you have to do to make that person trust you. And then once that wall is down, people are willing to be vulnerable. When people are willing to be vulnerable, they'll take risks. When people are willing to take risks, you can get to see the best version of them. Yeah. But otherwise, you get to see the reserved version of people.
Yeah.
So it feels like, and, you know, in terms of like, I think one of the things that, like you've described a form of verbal communication that doesn't necessarily require two people speaking to each other for two people to speak to each other.
Yeah.
That's what communication is. As long as the thing is achieved, you know, like the Wittgenstein thing, like the that language is just I ask for a thing, whether you know what the thing is or not. If I get what I want, then communication has been achieved.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if we have the same language. We don't have to. That's like, and that goes beyond life and death. That's the experience of all humans. That's the Pangea of the human experience that has to come back together, is that we can find ways to communicate without having to feel like we were understood. Like, that's the big fear.
Yeah.
It's like, do people get me? Do people understand me? No, just try to understand other people and they will reciprocate. That's how communication works.
I mean, I think it's like anticipation. Like, you anticipate, like, you know, and you empathize.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sort of like using both those skills to like figure out how to create like a safe space.
So you were like early in your early 20s when you were going through this?
Yeah. 23, 24.
So at that time, you know, we asked that question about you know, how much you think about death.
Yes.
Was that a 10 period in your life?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were a lot of the people, so you did you have a lot of experiences with the people you were working with dying?
Yeah, so one of, in early on when I started working there, one of the residents passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And at the home, because it was a hippie, unconventional sort of home, they had a procedure where they would put the body on dry ice, and they would keep the body preserved in their the person's bedroom, and then they would kind of collect all the pictures of the person throughout their entire life and candles and things and put it in the bedroom. And then the person who had passed away, their family could come and go into the bedroom and stay as long as they wanted and say their goodbyes. So that would go on for like a couple of days. And I think one of the reasons also, like the residents who were living there but who were sick could also go in and see the body and kind of commune with it, or, you know, understanding that maybe somewhere in the back of their head, like, that could be me, that will probably be me, and this is what will happen. And so it would make them feel, I guess, less anxious about the experience, and just to have death in your home and to not have it be a scary thing.
Did it make it less scary for you?
I was like nervous because I had gotten a call right before I went on shift, and they're like, okay, the resident, you know, passed away, so when you come in, just be aware of that, heads up. And it was really a beautiful day.
Yeah.
It was like shocking. I thought it was, at first I was like, it's going to be really creepy and weird. And this is such a weird thing. And I, like, how am I going to feel about this? And then I got there, and there was this guy like playing guitar in the room, yeah. which was really beautiful, yeah. and all the residents were singing in the room, yeah. and like when you know people were kind of coming in, and there was like a really beautiful like just light coming in. It just felt warm. It didn't yeah. feel scary, yeah. you know. It didn't feel, you know, terrible. Yeah. It felt right. like it was like sort of like just a passing.
Yeah.
You know. So.
How many did you see? Like how many
just
passings?
One.
Oh, you just saw one passing. Okay.
There, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And then at the homeless shelter. So at the so you were also working graveyard at the homeless shelter, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you have experience more death there?
Yeah, there was like a couple residents that I really liked who would just not come back, and you would hear like that they died. There was one resident who was really sad. His wife had gotten hit by a car outside of the shelter and died. And he was never, I mean, he was already in a bad place, but after that, he was never really the same. And then One time, I had just, I guess, been working at the shelter for a few months, and I was walking down the street not far from my house, and I saw him like passed out in the bushes, like with a cigarette in his hand, like kind of burning a hole through his pants and through his leg, just really drunk. And I just had to kind of walk him over to the gas station and call the ARC, which was like this place where people could detox, because the shelter was a fairly dry shelter, so you couldn't really go in wasted. He was just, you know, just sort of like a lost person.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. And also working at the shelter was interesting because, you know, I lived in Boulder, which is a very like kind of like Google's there now. You know what I mean? Like it has sort of this like sort of rich edge to it, you know? So then I tell people I worked at a shelter in Boulder. They're like, there's poor people in Boulder? Yeah. And I'm like, oh, there's poor people everywhere. But yeah, so that was interesting. And then, you know, once I sort of started working there, then I would, this like a kind of like little, like the Ewok Village sort of came out, you know, like during the day where I would be like, I know all these people from the shelter. Yes. And I would never know that they lived in a shelter. But I know now. Yeah, yeah. Like just hanging out on the street or like socializing or just, you know, going throughout their day. They don't look like a crazy bad person, you know, like they're normal people.
Yeah.
For the most part, I mean, there's obviously mental illness and things like that, but there are people that, like, you would pass, you know, by and you would never think twice, like, oh, this person is, like, in a shelter.
Yeah.
And then I felt like I knew everyone in the town after working at the shelter because I'd, like, walk down this one specific street and I'd, like, say hi to everyone, like, how's it going?
Yeah.
You know, like, hey. It was such a weird feeling to suddenly then, like, sort of, like, see the street differently.
Yeah. So, like, how old were the people that, like, on average, was
there
it just
were
a wide
young
range?
People there. There young? Were no, okay. no. There were a wide range, but there were definitely like young people there. Like there was like 20-year-olds, and then mostly men. I'd say the demographic was primarily men. It wasn't a family shelter, so it was, you know, like people who were single, or they're in relationships or whatever.
Yeah.
But no families.
Yeah.
But yeah. So anywhere between, you know, like 70 to like 20.
Wow.
But the young people always like really surprised me.
Yeah.
I think at one point there was like a young one that like had asked out someone that worked at the shelter because we're all young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a strange thing.
Yeah. They're your peers.
Yeah. You're like it's like it makes you realize what a very specific divide you place between a person who's homeless and a person who's not.
Yeah. And I'm not making crazy money. I'm making $11 an hour.
Yeah.
Especially in like in that area, like the difference between like a homeless person and like a college student at Boulder is just like a dorm room. Yeah. You know, like they basically all look like.
Yeah. No.
drugged out hippies.
I know. It's funny because like the other day I was like walking by like a Trader Joe's and there were like some kind of hippie guys like outside of Trader Joe's. Yeah. Like there was a time in my life, maybe when I was like 17, where I wouldn't. Like, I might have been attracted.
Yeah.
I would have been like, I don't know. Yeah, let's go.
Yeah, if they talk to you, you'd be like,
this person's really, you know, in a low place.
Stacy's out at Squatter's Point again.
I met a mysterious man.
Yeah, I wonder how many people like have
very true
have gone on like a few dates before realizing that like the guy that they're dating is.
Yeah, totally.
Probably has to happen.
I'm sure.
I mean, you could still get Tinder if you didn't have a home. I mean, that's one of the things I've noticed is that cell phones are pretty ubiquitous at this point. Yeah.
No, totally.
Well, I like the improv show that I do every week. We like improvise based on people's internet search history. And we had a guest one time, you know, come up and give us his phone. And through looking at his search history, whoever was doing the interview, like a lot of the searches were sort of
shelters.
Like public showers, like, you know, free places to park. It was, and it became clear that this guy like had like probably a car, but was homeless. And you wouldn't have told, you know, noticed. Yeah. You know, like nothing about him like seemed like what you think of when you think of a homeless person. And we were able to like catch it quickly enough that we didn't like, you know, because in that show you ask why someone Googled something. But you know, it, you try to stay enough steps ahead where like you don't embarrass somebody.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, but it was so striking because it was like you never would have known. And you just don't know.
Yeah, and that was one of the rules also, like, working at the shelter, sort of like, you can't acknowledge you know them because you know them through, like, it's anonymous, you know? So, like...
Like a therapist or something.
Yes, like a therapist. So, like, if you're out in the world, if they acknowledge you, then you can acknowledge them.
Oh.
So it's sort of like...
Yeah.
Yeah, so they can, set the... Yeah. Sort of, parameters.
That's
like if you're
I
at a party and like someone you know they like live they stay at the shelter and like they don't want you know
everybody
anyone to know that, then you're not like, hey, I know you from the shelter.
That
How's it going?
That sounds great to me. Like that's already how I am at parties. I just pretend I don't know people until they come up to me. So it's like, sorry, I'm working at this homeless shelter now. I'm not allowed to make eye contact with you.
So was this the same period of time when your dad passed away?
Yeah, he was diagnosed when I was working there, and then he passed away after. So I had stopped working at those places, and then he passed away maybe like a year or two after that.
Do you think about I watched your short film?
Oh,
which
thanks for
is,
watching.
Oh,
it.
It's amazing! I loved it. It was really moving and special. And so like you talked about those three things all in the film. Like, so do you think about them a lot, sort of as part of the same umbrella of time in your life, or did you just like link them together for the film? Like,
no, I mean, I think of that as like just a huge like. I mean, that's why Boulder especially is really close to my heart, because I feel like I really like grew up there,
because
of all those things I experienced in those jobs, and then also with my father's illness.
Yeah.
So, I think in some ways the jobs helped me. Help my dad in a way that I wouldn't have been able to, because I am, especially the hospice job, because I just had to be around bodies a lot. They were unhealthy. And I don't mean that in a way that's like something they have control over.
Sure.
I just mean like sick people, you know? So having to be then around my dad who's sick, which is different, you know, helping someone who is not your family feels different than helping someone that is your family.
In what way?
I think because like, you know, your dad, like, knew you as a kid, or my dad knew me as a kid, and he like took care of me, and he was sort of this huge part of my life, and I felt safe with him, and I felt like he was unstoppable.
Sure.
He was just such a strong figure in my life. Then to see him, for me to have to help him go to the bathroom, or see someone put a catheter in him, or you know, to just these things that people would have to do to his body that I would have to witness or help.
Yeah.
Like, that is, like, it's not just your dad. It's like, oh, we're all just these bodies in a way.
Yeah.
And it is, like, a different awakening than just when you're helping someone that's not, you know, that you don't know that intimately, I guess.
Yeah.
Did it help, did the experience of, when you described the sort of the beautiful experience of, like, reflecting on life in passing, did that help when it was time for you to go through it with your dad, or is there nothing that can help when you're that close to another person?
Did working in those jobs help?
Like seeing that death that you described at the hospice, and then you said like you were very afraid of going into it, but that it was a sort of a cathartic emotional, like, did it help when you were then dealing with it on a personal level, or is there just nothing that can help when?
Well, I think it helped like with the initial like experience of the death, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. the grief, it was different. I mean, because I think grief like lasts a really long time, or it did for me. It lasted, and I still have moments of grief about it, but for years. So, but in as far as seeing, you know, the woman at the hospice who had died, what was interesting at the time to me was just that, like, her face was so smooth. Mm. It was just kind of like this release. Like, there was definitely, like, this... You're looking at a shell. Like, you just... Whatever was, like, stressing or, like, whatever was gone. Yeah. And that was interesting. And I think for my dad... What's good with having seen that is that there is like this other mysterious aspect of life that is undefinable, and there is a release that comes with death.
Yeah.
So
the release of that stress that was
suffering, the pain. Yeah,
that's
like,
a good way to put it.
There is like this sort of release that happens. And,
yeah, I mean, you often hear people describe that, you know, there is like that sort of lack of life in a face, but I think I like the way that you described it better, where it seems like the stressors of life have been removed and there's like sort of a smoothness to that face that maybe doesn't at first look natural to you, but maybe what you've grown accustomed to the look of someone who has some suffering.
Yeah, it's like a shell in a way. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's interesting. But yeah, I mean, I think having those jobs definitely helped me think about bodies in a different way, and I mean, I talk about that a little bit in the film, and just how it's given me a more of an appreciation, I guess, for just my own body. Even, you know, though I have my own struggles, you know, like, I feel like comparatively, you know, I am reminded, like, okay, like, I don't have cancer right now. Like, I don't have, like, there's so many... And right now, like, I don't know what's going to happen to my body. You know, I don't know. So I have to really appreciate it for the moment and just try to live in it. And it's not always, I can say that now.
Yeah.
Sure. But it's like something I think of.
How much do you end up thinking back to those jobs in that period in your life now that you're a mother? Like, do those dots connect a lot?
Yeah, they connect a lot. I think because my son, so I have a son, and he's 4 months old, and it's the same thing I was talking to, I guess, earlier about, okay, there's a being that's in my life that can't talk.
Alan.
Yeah. Oh, molasses.
All right, thanks, guys. I'm gonna roll up out of here. I've done my part.
A flawless little
singer. Drop the mic.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah.
No, it's, so it's kind of crazy where it's like, oh, yeah, this is exactly, you know, like my experience. I keep touching. So it's this person I have this relationship with that, can't communicate in the same way as I'm used to communicating. Yeah. But he's with me, you know, he's present, and I'm starting to know him. Like, I'm getting to know him, which is interesting. So.
What, can you think of any examples, like, of any moments where, I don't know, you feel like there's, like, a moment of powerful communication where you're like, oh, check it out. We didn't need words. Or like,
I think just he's starting to smile now. Oh. And also with the kids, like, I didn't realize, like, that they're like these little machines that just slowly start to wake up. Like, they're sort of like, okay, like, he's eating, you know, he's like a slug, or I keep using these comparisons, but it's like, you don't really, it's not like a personality. Yeah. You know, you don't really see them, but
yeah.
And then now, because he's 4 months finally, like, he's starting to smile and get excited and like, because he knows that I'm going to bring food.
Meaning you? You are the food.
Exactly. Like, I am the food. Like, he gets pumped. Like, whatever problem suffering with is like, finally, it's going to be okay. He gets really pumped, you know?
It's much creepier when I treat women like food. It might just be the women.
Well, you are a non-cannibal.
This is true, It's not just a rap name. It's not just my moniker. Yeah. I am a known cannibal. So what makes him happy? What things make him besides food? Like what can you do to make it get a good like smile or laugh out of him?
He loves standing.
Yeah,
like he can't quite stand.
Yeah. He loves you at a shot.
Yeah, but if you put him like on a table or something, like he pretends to stand and he gets really excited.
So fun. Yeah. Well, it makes sense because if you never did it before, like I've been trying to do a handstand for truly the past 10 years of my life, and I think I will never actually get it, but I often feel really close.
Yeah.
And nothing feels cooler. And to think of like having never have stood before to have a foot stand feel like a handstand.
I know. It makes me feel really powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's this funny like face where he's just like, I get it. I'm powerful now.
It's crazy some of the things that you'll say they're not hyperbole. Nothing feels cool.
You
have a sunny like excitement for life, but it is the advanced version. At some point, basically, what it comes down to, and this is the analogy, is that eventually we need to start walking on our hands in order to feel the sense of satisfaction that originated with just learning to walk like a human being.
Yeah. And I'm so impressed that you're trying that still.
Yeah.
I really
can't imagine.
Yeah.
What,
give it a shot
do
right
you do
now.
It by yourself at your house? Or
against a wall, usually.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I really want to do it. Yeah.
Really?
I can't do the hands, but I mean, I can obviously lean against the wall.
Yeah.
But getting upright.
I did I stood for like a couple seconds today without the wall.
Nice.
It's amazing.
Thank you.
Victory.
Go do it.
Yay, baby Madeline.
I love it.
That's great. Well, Stacey, this was such a fun time talking with you.
It was so great talking to you guys.
Tell our listeners where they can find you on the internet. Give us some plugs.
Can people see that film, or is it password protected still?
It's password protected at the moment. But if you go to my website, it's StaceyElaine.com, and on there you might find like links to various projects that I've done in the past, and you can see some stills. It's called Back to Abstraction. And it's a short film I did with Matthew Cazeta, and many other wonderful humans that I admire. I have like a newsletter, and you can also like sign up for the newsletter on my website,
which
is fun.
Yeah. I just got it today.
Thanks. I'm excited about it. And then also I have a podcast with Kate Purdy.
Past guest.
Who I love. And
she's great.
She's great. It's called Life Wife, and you can find that on iTunes.
Ooh, that's great. Yeah.
That's awesome. And tell them on the social medias where they can find you.
Oh, yeah. On Instagram, I'm Pizza Stacy. And on Twitter, just plain Stacy Dasho.
Great.
Ha. Woohoo.
I wish everyone would do that after they gave their social media. I'm at Ben Axelrod. Ha ha.
I can't stop moving my arms, which is why I kept hitting the mic. I'm like,
I do too, I'm a gesticulator like crazy.
I am a crazy.
I gotta get some air, otherwise I have to fly away.
I remember when Alan coached one of my improv teams. His biggest note was like, you gotta stop moving your hands like that. Nobody acts like that. I always look like a cartoon. And
that
it's
is
true.
Like,
there is,
every time I start gesticulating, I'm like, I've turned into cartoon Kathy. But hey, we're excited. That's what we do when we get excited. We gesture.
We move our hands.
We handstand.
And it's been an exciting time with you guys.
It's been such an exciting time with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been Definitely Dying. Thank you guys so much for listening.
Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes, and you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Definitely Dying.
Until next time, stay healthy.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.